Part to come in, to going out. This amplitude will have some specific singularity when the sum of the moment of two particles goes on shell for some third particle. The singularity in terms of Fermi diagram really comes from this diagram, which has a what as a propagator. So this shows you clearly that there is a singularity when this sum squared goes to minus m squared. So at tree level, you find poles whose residues are the product of like this. So you find poles whose residue is the product of the amplitudes with three legs. So essentially taking poles, taking discontinuities allow you to cut your amplitude into smaller pieces. And among other things, this fixes the relative normalization of amplitudes. If you decide how to normalize the three-point function, the scattering amplitudes of three particles, this will fix the normalization of the scattering amplitude of four particles. It is kind of useful in string theory, because you know we are computing these amplitudes as correlation functions of two-dimensional field theory on a funny surface. When you compute the correlation functions of quantum field theory in two dimensions, you might mess up the overall normalization very easily. It's very difficult to keep track of the overall normalization. But you don't need to. Once you pick out to normalize, say, the three-point functions, then the normalization of all the other more complicated diagrams can be fixed just by looking at the poles or discontinuities and requiring unitarity. So string perturbation theory gives you unitary scattering amplitude when things are normalized properly. Okay. Now let me discuss the third fact about quantum field theory. So very often quantum field theory is useful to introduce sources. So for example, suppose you're studying QED. You want to study some corrections to the energy levels of the hydrogen atom. It's pretty convenient to treat the electron fully in quantum field theory as a particle which has loops that can appear and disappear. But at the same time, the proton, which is very much, much heavier, can be treated reasonably as a fixed object which is sitting there. In other words, it's possible to, first of all, do a calculation in which you take a limit where the proton is infinitely heavy. If you take that limit, you don't want to treat the proton with a quantum field. Instead, you only care about the interaction of this proton with the photons. So you want to study Feynman diagrams where there is this proton which is sitting here at all times, at the origin of space-time, and never moving. And is exchanging photons with your electrons. Okay. So this is done by just adding a source to your quantum field theory action. Essentially, you take the action of QED, and then you add to it pretty much just the integral of A naught along the position of your proton. Maybe I'll put in front the charge of nucleus. Here you put the charge. Okay. So this is a very standard thing to do in quantum field theory. Very useful. is what's called sometimes a Wilson line. These are modifications of your quantum field theory, which are not like, we differ from local operators because they're not just changing it here at one point. They're changing it along some submanifold. Now, today I would like to do something like that for string theory. Okay? I want to answer the question, can we add sources to string theory? Now, just because string theory includes gravity, it's clear that things are going to be a little bit more elaborate than here, although perhaps not much. See, already here, there are constraints that come from gauge symmetry. For example, in QD, you could not add a source representing a proton which exists forever and then suddenly disappears. Okay? This will violate current conservation. It will give you a coupling to longitudinal modes. It would source non-physical modes in your theory. So definitely you don't want to do that. If you had a theory of gravity instead of QD, then similarly your source, which would be the stress tensor, should be conserved. Matter could not just pop out of existence. And the same is true for momentum. So in the theory of gravity, whenever you want to introduce a source, you need to do it very carefully because the source must be able to, the source cannot have an infinite mass, because otherwise it would source an infinite gravitational field. And if it has a finite mass, it must be able to back react. If you hit it, it must move, otherwise you violate moment conservation. So it's clear that a string theory includes gravity. Sources will have to have some dynamics. But let's start by being as naive as possible. So let's try to draw a diagram that looks like this in string theory. Okay. So I have my source, whatever that is. I have some strings coming in. Let me try to do something that looks like the simplest possible quantum field theory diagram. You know, an electron that comes in and bounces off the proton by exchanging a photon. So the string that comes in, bounces off, and so I need to have a prong of this surface which ends on my source. So this, unfortunately, I'm drawing these ends and they look a lot like this end, but they're fundamentally different. This really represents a worksheet that is going to go all the way to infinity. Come see the specific state. Okay. Here, the worksheet is really just ending. If I do a wild transformation to make this into a simpler geometry, it will look not like a sphere, but like a half of a sphere. So I can do a wild transformation that sort of squeezes in these infinite tubes into points. But this is just a boundary, and it remains a boundary. I could also draw that as simply this. So here, my source is encoded by some choice of a boundary condition for my worksheet theory. For example, if I want this source to sit at the origin of space, then it means that when the string ends, it must end at the origin. That looks like some sort of Dirichlet boundary condition on the position of the string. It says the position of the string must approach zero as you approach the boundary. So in general, my scattering amplitude would be a sum over surfaces, which has a bunch of these infinite tubes. Some handles and some boundaries. It's up to me to choose which boundary conditions, which sources do I allow. If I'm just introducing one source, each of these boundaries, representing a string that ends on that source, will have the same boundary condition. So I'll write my amplitude in the presence of this source as a sum of the number of handles, sum of the number of boundaries, and then. And then the result of some calculation in my two-dimensional quantum field theory on a surface with a certain number of handles and a certain number of boundaries. Now, for now, I left the intensity of the source arbitrary. We'll come back to this in a moment. Okay. So this lambda now plays the same role as this charge. When I computed a diagram here, I would get a factor of the charge at each interaction point to the source. Okay, so now, of course, I could put multiple sources, right? In which case I would take a collection of boundary conditions. And for each boundary, I would have to pick which source is it ending on. So I would need to sum over the boundaries of type A. Every amplitude will be labeled by how many holes, how many boundaries of type 1, how many boundaries of type 2, how many boundaries of type 3, and so on and so forth. Okay. And at this point, I could just leave it at that, take my theory of a string in a flat space, pick a simple boundary condition, and start computing. I mean, that would be a good idea. But instead, I'm going to continue with some general considerations first. So, let's look at this kind of diagram. Okay. So, I drew the diagram in a way that resembles quantum field theory. And we know from previous experience that string theory diagrams will behave like quantum field theory diagrams, at least in the region of the space of matrix, where the matrix looks indeed like having long, thin tubes. Now, I haven't discussed yet how the space of matrix in the presence of boundary looks like, but roughly, at least in this example, I can anticipate that the way it looks like, you take your disk with fixed size, say one, and you move your points. Actually, in principle, you could put a point in the middle of the disk and just move the other one. Now, if you take the two points very close to each other, and you use in the wild transformation to blow them up into tubes, it is to see that you get indeed a picture like that, which long tubes, infinite tubes connected to a long tube to my boundary. Okay. But you can also consider an opposite limit. Where one of the points is very close to the boundary. You can do a wild transformation to make this into semi-infinite tubes, and you can check that what you get looks like this. So it looks like a tow string that propagates for a while, then a hole opens up, closes again, and the tow string keeps propagating. So this is the same topology as this, but a different metric. And it turns out that when you do you compute this amplitude of two strings in the presence of the boundary, you find two sets of poles. One set of poles is the familiar one. So you find poles like 1 over p1 plus p2 squared plus m squared. But this is the mass of a closed string. These poles come from integrating over the length of this tube. But you also find different poles. They behave like just like 1 over p1 squared plus a different set of masses. Well, not exactly P1, but almost. We'll see. So it really looks like, so these poles do not look like poles that correspond to the propagation of closed strings. So unitarity is imply, together with the existence of these poles, implies that there is something else going on. There are some other excitations in our theory that we didn't account for. So if you look at this diagram, the way you should think about it is that there is a closed string that is propagating, and at some point opens up into an open string. And then closes it again. So you see the cylinder is opening up into a ribbon. And then closing into a cylinder again. And these open strings are exactly the new degrees of freedom, which appear that unitarity predicts because of these poles. So we started the day by adding sources to the theory, and automatically the theory is giving to us degrees of freedom attached to these sources, extra degrees of freedom associated to these sources. So as I said, gravity requires sources to be dynamical. In string theory, the degrees of freedom, string theory produces for us the degrees of freedom involved in these dynamics. So we put sources, and string theory produced dynamics for these sources. So in particular, these open stream modes, among other things, include degrees of freedom which allow the source to move or fluctuate. But they include much more. For example, if you include multiple sources, and you look at the diagram we'll say some examples. If you look at a diagram that accounts for the interaction between the two sources, the force between them, say, which is mediated by a exchange of a closed string. This looks like a like that. The whole sheet looks like that. Like an annulus. And you can also interpret it as a loop, or as a ribbon closed into a loop. So a one loop of an open string stretched between the two sources. So you get dynamical, you get, besides the dynamical degrees of freedom associated with a single source, string theory gives you dynamical degrees of freedom associated to each pair of sources. And these are really the least intuitive part of the story of D-brains and the most interesting. For example, it tells you that if you take many copies of the same source, you get degrees of freedom attached to these sources, which are matrices. If I take n copies of B, I get n square open string stretched between these copies and themselves. So whenever you talk about D-brains in string theory, you end up talking about things like non-abelian DH theories, theories whose fields are matrices. Now, after looking at these pictures, we can come back to this. So, see, let's look at this diagram again, or a diagram with multiple closed strings and a single boundary. So if I change the intensity to the source, I will change this diagram by a certain amount, or even this diagram. Let me look at this diagram, is a particularly clean one. Suppose this diagram comes to the weight lambda 1, lambda 2 over g squared. Right? It has no handles, it has two boundaries. So it comes with lambda 1, lambda 2 over g squared. Now, on the other hand, I just said that by unitarity, this should also be interpreted. This is the behavior associated to also a loop of an open string. Now, a loop amplitude is not something I can just multiply by whatever I want, because the discontinuities of this loop amplitude count the number of particles that are propagating around the loop. So I cannot just take this and multiply it by square root of 2. It will completely destroy the interpretation of this as a unitary quantum field theory. Instead, this diagram should be proportional to the number of species that are going around the loop, the number of particles. So it turns out that this combination must be really written as N1 and N2. Should be an integer, and should be counting the number of open strings between these two boundaries. All I can do is to give these boundaries multiplicities, N1 and N2. So this should have given, you know, this could have been proportional to an integer. I can allow this integer to be multiplied by independent, to split into independent contributions from one, from the intensity of one boundary and the intensity of the other boundary. But the intensity of the boundary is quantized. So in order to allow me to reinterpret these pictures and the poles. Okay, so let me say properly from the beginning. So these amplitudes will have extra poles different from the ones that you expect from closed strings. In order for this picture to be unitary, this pulse had to be interpreted as the propagation of some other degrees of freedom. And the counting only works if these sources are not generic, but are quantized. So I rewrite this now as g to the 2h minus 2 plus the number of boundaries times the number of copies of that boundary. And here, the same way, as I will replace lambda with some g and a. Okay. So it's a bit funny. In QED, if I have two protons, the strength of the interaction between them is controlled by the coupling. You would say that it's charged times the coupling squared. So in particular, if electromagnetism becomes weaker and weaker, I would expect the protons to interact less and less. On the other hand, because the interaction between these sources has to be reinterpreted as a one-loop diagram, whose intensity is essentially quantized, it means that the interaction between these sources cannot just go to zero. So a way to think about it is, does the sources go like 1 over g? So if you write an effective action associated to these amplitudes, you had a 1 over g squared times the action of the closed strings. Including the graviton, the dilaton, the B field, and whatever else. And then the reduction of the open strings. Which includes in particular sources for the closed strings. And has 1 over G string in front of it. And really this. Right, this, if you have n copies of, this, of a source, these open strings look, really are a matrix. Right. And you have a trace. Okay. Any questions? This is a bit abstract, but I wanted to just put down the general ideas before we get to do concrete calculations. Mm-hmm. So the effective action for the closed strings accounts for all sorts of interactions where a certain number of closed strings come together. Then you have an effective action for the which describes the interaction of the closed strings with the open strings, or with the source in general. So for example, there would be terms that look like, a closed string coming in and ending, and this would be some source for the closed string. So some extra linear term in the closed strings. There will be terms which describe a closed string converting into an open string. There will be terms describing a closed string coming in and opening up into two. open strings, and so on and so forth. Right, and if you count right, if you count the powers of G string that are implied by this formula, then you find that this process, the propagator of closed strings, comes with one over with a G squared, while the propagator of an open string comes with a G. And these processes come with 1 over g squared, while these processes come with 1 over g. It takes a little bit of time to just assemble these blocks together into pictures and just make sure that the picture, that the overall power in front of the picture does not change if you cut it in different ways. So this is sort of a consistent way to give a weight to processes, in such a way that the same surface can be chopped up in different ways and give the same result. And now, so this will give you a term in the effective action. It looks like phi closed cube, for example. This will give you a term in the effective action, which looks like just phi closed times some source. This will give you something that looks like phi closed trace of phi open. Let me just write it. Sum over A, phi open AA. If I create a boundary, I had the same boundary on the top and on the bottom. The open string modes are labeled by which boundaries do they end on. So here I have phi closed, phi open, AA. Here I'm creating two different boundaries. So I get something like sum over A and B, phi closed, phi open, AB, phi open, BA. I could also write it as phi closed trace of phi open squared, if I treat phi open as a matrix. Okay. Now, this point would probably be instructive to devote some time to the combinatorics of the quantum field theory whose fields are matrices. There is a lot of fun to be had there. There is something called the Tuft expansion. But I suspect you'll do it in the next string course at the very beginning. So it's probably going to be redundant to it now. So let's see. Any more questions? Okay, so now with this general picture where we had boundaries as sources, we get new degrees of freedom, and we get an effective low energy theory of open strings and closed strings. It naturally schematically looks like this. So at this point, it looks like we have many different choices of how to define a string theory. We pick our closed string theory, and then we pick a certain number of these sources called D-brains. Yes? Oh, they're all there. Yes. So we can pick different boundary conditions. And for every choice of boundary conditions of D-brains we make, we get a different perturbative string theory. Okay. Now, these boundary conditions have continuous parameters, but matches the continuous parameters of the closed string theory. These are really expectation values of fields. But still, we have, even if, so we shouldn't think about these continuous parameters as different choices, but still there are different discrete choices which types of boundaries to add. I can, from this, at the perturbative point of view, things seem to be make perfect sense if I don't put any dibrains, or if I put one dibrain, or I put two. And in these lectures, we are not going to be able to get to a point where we can see that these dibrains are really a necessary component of string theory. But it is the case. So string theory, in order for string theory to make sense, you need to allow for processes in which these dibrains might really be created and destroyed. So here they're treated as dynamical sources, like a dynamical proton. But for string theory to really make sense, they need to be treated as quantum field, as quantum fields, as particles of some quantum fields. Something that can be created and destroyed. They are very heavy in string perturbation theory because they give sources that go like 1/decoupling. But still, non-perturbatively, they should be really just particles of a field. So in particular, in certain calculations, you can find singularities which are interpreted as arising from loops of dibrains. So from processes where a dibrain runs in a loop, where one of these objects runs in a loop. Not the open string themselves, but the objects the open strings are attached to. Okay, now back to perturbation theory. Let's start reviewing how would we do calculations like this. Okay. So how do we insert boundaries in our formalism for string theory? So we want to insert boundaries in a way that will not mess up our diffeomorphism and wild gauge symmetries. Now, I cannot really introduce a boundary in a way that does not affect diffeomorphisms at all. Just because if I put a boundary here and I do a translation, clearly the boundary is moving. The best I can ask from a boundary is to be invariant under diffeomorphisms that leaves the boundary at the same location. So if I put a boundary here, I cannot ask for the setup to be invariant under a translation in this direction, but I can ask for it to be invariant under a translation in this direction, which leaves the shape of the boundary unaffected. So in terms of vector fields, my gauge group consists of vector fields with the property that the component perpendicular to the boundary at the location of the boundary is zero. This is going to be my gauge group, together with wild transformations. You know. Now, as I mentioned before, in the quantum field theory, invariance under diffeomorphisms implies a certain property of the stress tensor which should be conserved. Right. Now, when you study conservation law for the stress tensor, or for anything else, or any current, right? You do something like this. You can say, okay, I have the integral of on space of the stress tensor a long time contracted with my vector field, and I want this to be invariant under. So conservation laws are just conservations of some charges under time translations. Charges which are built out of the stress tensor contact with the vector field. There you show this type of relations that you bring the derivative inside the integral, use the conservation law to rewrite it as a total derivative. And then you integrate it by part to zero. But if you have a boundary now, let's say put at x1 equal to zero, then integration by part does not give me zero, not necessarily. It gives me the stress tensor at the boundary. Okay. So for quantum field theory to have the conservation laws in the presence of the boundary, the stress tensor, we need to impose this condition that this should be zero. So the component of the stress tensor perpendicular to the boundary contracted with these vector fields restricted to the boundary should be zero. Okay. Physically, this condition can be thought of as a statement that no energy can flow in from the boundary. So, when we gauge fix, this sort of constraints will also affect which boundary conditions do we set on the ghosts. Okay, because the C ghosts will have to satisfy the same boundary conditions as our diffeomorphisms. And the B ghosts to have BRST symmetry should have the same properties as the stress tensor, essentially. Now, in holomorphic coordinates, so this in particular means that T perpendicular parallel at the boundary should be zero. So the T with an index parallel to the boundary, one perpendicular to the boundary, should be zero. Now, let's see which kind of boundary conditions can we find for a free scalar. So let's consider our usual scalar field X with action dx, d bar x. Now, can you give me some examples of boundary conditions for a scalar? No, you haven't encountered any kind of boundary conditions? Okay. Okay. My condition one, Dirichlet. X equal to some specific value at the boundary. Let me give you another one. Neumann. The normal derivative of X is zero at the boundary. Notice that this implies that the derivative of x parallel to the boundary is zero. Now, if you plug this into the stress tensor, you see that other choice will work. These are two good boundary conditions. Indeed, they are diffeomorphism and Wall invariant. They're good boundary conditions for a conformal field theory. Now, if you express these boundary conditions in terms of dolomorphic and antilomorphic currents, they look like that. While this boundary condition looks like that at the boundary. I hope I wrote this formula right. There are slightly different signs if you're considering a vertical or an horizontal boundary, and I always get them mixed up. But I think this is right. Yeah. Okay. So notice if you remember from when we were looking at T-duality switched the sign of the antilomorphic component of X. So the duality actually relates Dirichlet and Neumann boundary condition. Initially, when people studied open string in string theory, they always focused on Neumann boundary conditions, because it seemed to be reasonable that if you're adding some new degrees of freedom, these degrees of freedom should be living everywhere. They didn't want to break Lorentz invariants. They want sources which were uniform everywhere. The Dirichlet boundary condition is not uniform. The Dirichlet boundary condition selects a specific position in space-time. But then T-duality forced them to consider also this type of boundary condition, where you have sources which are really localized in space. And this is what led to development of deep brains, of studying deep brains. In particular, you know, you can have sources which are really a point in space moving on time. So they are deep brain particles. Okay, so there are two different things we can do with these boundary conditions, two different questions we can answer immediately. We can ask which kind of sources do they correspond to, and we can ask which kind of open strings can stretch between boundary conditions of these two types. So to do that we need to do two different calculations involving, one involves the cylinder. Okay. We should ask, if I put a boundary at time zero . Which state does it produce? Right? I can put this boundary here and read off in the future which state of the string I produced. This sort of question will tell me about sources I can also consider a strip of infinite length with boundaries at sigma equal to 0 and sigma equal to pi. The same or possibly different boundaries. I can quantize material of a free scalar on a strip. And this will tell me which open strings states exist. Okay. So we'll do these two calculations tomorrow.
I have a question. Do you think about the difference as an actual physical object? Because originally, I guess at least originally people thought about strings as kind of representing particles, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Here the brains. How do you kind of connect it to a physical reality?
Well, it depends in part on which kind of brains are we looking at. For example, if I look at a brain that is really localized in space, this would be another particle. If I look at a brain that is extended in space, for example, a brain that extends along the blackboard, that will support some new degrees of freedom, meaning I would have a universe where something lives in the room and something else lives on the blackboard. Of course, you can imagine a situation where we live on the blackboard inside a bigger universe. So you can use this in some modeling. You can use deep brains to support the degrees of freedom which we see, except for gravity. So there will be gravity moving in higher dimensional space, and then there will be some 3+1 dimensional brain in which we'll. On which we live.
So they're more abstract.
Yes, so they're just they're a big tool bag that you can add to perturbative string theory to describe many more things. And now, of course, so another way to think about it is that they enlarge the scope of perturbation theory. So a calculation made with deep brains is a calculation which would have been non-perturbative in closed string theory. But becomes perturbative in this larger, in this enlarged setup. So in the original closed string theory, these deep brains can sometimes be thought of as solitons of some sort. Some big complicated thing made out of closed strings. Now, if that was the case, they would be impossible to describe in perturbation theory. But instead, this gives you an alternative way to describe them, which is perturbative. Now, if you get into a bit deeper into this matters of Tuft expansion, then this existence of alternative point of views can become very powerful. So this theory of open strings, open and closed strings. If you just focus on the closed strings, it is really adding sources for the closed strings. It's just describing the motion of the closed strings in a complicated background. So I don't know, I have flat space, I put a whole bunch of deep brains to the origin, and all of a sudden I'm getting the propagation of the open strings of the closed strings in the background of something that is essentially a black hole. As long as I put a sufficient number of of open string of dplanes. And somehow there is a general principle of open closed duality, which tells you that some calculations can be done in both ways. You could literally study the motion of closed strings in a black hole geometry, or you can consider closed string in flat space plus loops of open strings. And this should give you the same result. Then Maldacena took a sort of decoupling limit where it threw away the flat space. It was just left with the neighborhood of the black hole. And that led to the idea of holography, where the open strings, some quantum field theory of open strings by itself ends up encoding quantum gravity in the neighborhood of a black hole. Well, in terms of computationally, you can, if you want to read the mass of a D-brain, you would want to just see how much, what's the source for the graviton. So you do a calculation like this, and you check what's the coefficient for producing, what's the amplitude for producing a graviton, which scatters, which is brain, which this string scatter off from. So, right, when we do this calculation, we'll in particular learn about things like the mass or tension of a D-brain. Okay. Any more questions?